The second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Fred Earl Johnson. For the appellant, Mr. Johnson, is Mr. Brian Hall from the Minnehaha County Public Defender's Office. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Frank Gagan, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. Mr. Hall, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, this case raises some important double jeopardy issues that we would like the court to address. Just a brief review of the facts. On September 30th, 2004, Ms. Cassandra Breen was in the driveway of her parents' home in Baltic, South Dakota, and she was shot one time in the head. Very fortunately, Ms. Breen did survive that incident. My client, Mr. Johnson, her former boyfriend at the was her boyfriend at the time, was subsequently convicted and sentenced on attempted murder, aggravated assault, and the commission of a felony with a firearm. For each of those sentences, Mr. Johnson was sentenced separately. On the attempted murder, he was sentenced to 25 years in the state penitentiary. On the aggravated assault, he was sentenced to 15 years to be consecutive to the attempted murder. And on the commission of a felony of a firearm, he was sentenced to 25 years consecutive to the aggravated assault. And the key issue here before this court is that on that morning of September 30th, 2004, there was only one distinct single act. There was only one shot, one victim, and one injury. No one here disputes those facts. There was only one single incident, which raises this key issue of the fact that Mr. Johnson's double jeopardy rights under the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution in Article 6, Section 9 of the South Dakota Constitution were violated when he was convicted and sentenced for both the aggravated assault and the attempted murder. This court in the past has used the Blockberger test. This is a test that came down and was adopted by the South Dakota Supreme Court. It came down from Blockberger versus U.S. from 1932. It's a familiar test. It's one that this court has said should not be applied in a hyper-technical way. And the purpose of the Blockberger test is to determine whether multiple offenses are actually the same in fact and law, thereby preventing multiple punishments for the same single act.
Should we even get to the Blockberger test here? Because in State versus Weaver, we said established double jeopardy jurisprudence confirms that the legislature may impose multiple punishments for the same conduct without violating the double jeopardy clause if it clearly expresses its intent to do so. Well, clearly, there's no clear expression of intent to do so by the legislature here to punish for both murder and aggravated assault.
Exactly right, Justice Sabers. I would answer your question in two ways. To get the Blockberger test is a test of legislative intent to determine, the first step of that is to determine by on the face of the statutes, as you mentioned, whether or not the statutes authorize multiple punishments. And we're looking at three statutes here, the attempt statute, aggravated assault, and attempted murder. And on their face, none of those statutes authorize multiple punishments for a single act. And I think it's pretty clear that this legislature knows how to do that if it wants to. Specifically, in this case, Mr. Johnson was also convicted of the commission of a felony with a firearm, South Dakota Codified Law 22-14-12, which clearly states on its face that the defendant can be punished on this statute in addition to the underlying felony. So when the legislature wants to be specific and authorize cumulative or multiple punishments for a single act, it knows how to do so. And that's not the case here. And also, as a second answer to your question, Justice Sabers, should we even get to the elements test of Blockberger, would be in a case that was released at the same time as Blockberger, their State v. Perovich. This court did address the same issues as in Dillon, and it addressed the double jeopardy issue without going into the Blockberger analysis. And this case was similar to Dillon, State v. Dillon, in which the defendant in that case was convicted for a single act of sexual penetration and was charged and convicted of both the rape first and criminal pedophilia. And in that case, the court just took a look at the facts presented at the trial level. What facts were presented to the jury? What factual evidence did the prosecutor present? And in that case, the prosecutor in Perovich did not present, as this court stated, the prosecutor, neither the charging document nor the evidence to the jury, sought to distinguish the acts constituting criminal pedophilia from first-degree rape. In fact, they were the same act. And then went on to state that without factual evidence of two separate offenses or statutory authority, a jury conviction for multiple crimes for a single act of sexual penetration cannot stand. And that same analysis should apply here, where a single act of violence, one single act, but with two convictions, without factual evidence to distinguish between the two charges here, attempted murder and aggravated assault, can't stand. At trial, the prosecutor never attempted to establish two separate crimes of aggravated assault and attempted murder. We had just one shot, one injury, and one victim. The whole focus at trial was, from the opening statement to the evidence at trial to the closing, was this intent to kill. The doctor's testimony was how life-threatening Ms. Breen's injuries were. The closing statement focused on how the defendant had an intent to kill. This was all, the main focus of the prosecution was this attempted murder, and nothing was presented at the trial level to distinguish the attempted murder from the aggravated assault. So, to answer your question, perhaps we shouldn't even get to Blockburger. The South Dakota Supreme Court has, I would submit, added a new prong to the double jeopardy analysis in doing a factual test first to see if there's anything that was presented at trial to distinguish one act from the other. And if not, then you don't have to go to the Blockburger test at all. If so, then let's proceed to Blockburger, and that would be first to take a look at the legislative intent. On its face, both statutes do not, all three actually, do not authorize multiple punishments for a single act. So the next step, once that hurdle is met, once you realize that there's nothing on its face that allows for multiple punishments, the next step would be go to if the statute or the legislature is not explicitly clear that they authorize cumulative punishments, then the next step is to clarify legislative intent by taking a look at each statute and comparing them and seeing if each offense requires proof that the other does not. And this is the elements test or the offense test of Blockburger. And simply put, if each offense requires the same proof, they are the same offense and multiple punishments are prohibited. And when you compare the intent element with the of attempted murder with the intent element of aggravated assault, you have the intent to kill for attempted murder, you have the intent to commit serious bodily injury for aggravated assault. I guess I just want to break these down into two: acts of intent and then the conduct. So it's kind of a two-pronged analysis. And first take a look at the intent and then take a look at the conduct that resulted from that intent.
So there should, under your theory, there had to have been two shots for two charges?
It would have to be distinguishable.
If you fired the gun twice, then that would support the verdict that one shot won't do it. Two separate acts. Shoot two gun twice.
If there's evidence of two distinguishable acts,
Then
I think we're on a different level. In this case, there was only one shot, one injury, and one victim. There was nothing to distinguish the two. And then if you have just a single transaction, then you need to look at how the one intent swallows up the other. And in this case, the intent to kill should swallow up the intent to commit serious bodily injury. And I think the legislature is pretty clear in that, in the statute that creates a hierarchy of criminal intent. And as this court has addressed in State v. Giroux, specifically the South Dakota codified law 22-1-2, which does address the degrees of culpability from the least culpable to the most culpable. And that statute does allow that the greater degrees of culpability constitutes proof of lesser degrees of culpability, meaning malice includes intent, intent includes knowingly, knowingly includes reckless, and then reckless includes negligence. So the spirit of this statute indicates that the intent to commit serious bodily injury is swallowed up or included in the intent to kill. So you have the relationship of the two offenses is one of concentric circles rather than overlapping circles. You have the intent to kill swallowing up or enclosing the intent to commit bodily injury. And if you look at the conduct element, you have a range of choices. You have two different, these are not different offenses as far as the injury goes, but it's a spectrum of possible outcomes. And I guess you have no injury, somebody taking a shot and missing, to somebody near death, which would be the far range of the spectrum. And somewhere in between there on this continuum or the spectrum would be great bodily serious bodily injury or less than that. So it's a enclosed the bodily injury part is all contained in the spectrum of possible outcomes, of serious bodily injury just being one. So I think when you compare the elements in the same evidence test or the same offenses test of Blockberger, I think it's pretty clear that the greater offense of attempted murder, both with the intent element and the conduct element, swallows up the aggravated assault. And therefore, the Blockberger test is not met, and Mr. Johnson's double jeopardy rights were violated under both the South Dakota Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. And we'd ask the court to, if there's any, as this court has stated before, if there's no explicit indication of legislative intent to create cumulative punishments, and a rule of statutory construction, which the Blockberger test is, fails to certify that intent further, we ask the court to invoke the rule of lenity and presume a single act constitutes a single offense, and therefore vacate the conviction and sentence for aggravated assault. That's what we'd ask the court to do here. The second issue to discuss would be the violation of Mr. Johnson's Miranda rights, or Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination, when he was in custody and subjected to custodial interrogation while in Parker, South Dakota.
On one of those statements, he didn't admit to anything in those statements, did he?
He did not. You're right, Justice Minor. He did not.
So will you explain why, so what's the problem? Why he did not incriminate himself, I'm assuming.
I would submit that he did incriminate himself with statements that were at odds with each other. He did make various statements or different versions of his activities that night of the 29th and the morning of the 30th.
And how were those used in trial?
The prosecutor in that case had Detective Toft testify about the discrepancies in his story, as well as both his written statements that were written out, Mr. Johnson's statements that he wrote out with while being interrogated by Detective Toft, were submitted to the jury as well for their review during deliberations. So the jury did have these various versions that they were able to use in their deliberation.
Well, there were two occasions where he was questioned.
Right.
And the second one, he did receive all of his Miranda rights.
Yes.
And said he understood him and waived him.
Right, but I would submit that the taint that was from the Parker interrogation, just because he was given a brief Miranda warning in Sioux Falls, doesn't dissipate that taint of the Miranda violation in Parker.
Your client in those interviews consistently denied guilt, didn't he?
He has.
So wasn't that a way to allow you to get that to the jury by having the state put this in?
The statements should not have been admitted into evidence to begin with because of the Miranda violation. And forgive me if I misunderstood the question, but the issue is whether or not his statement should have even been submitted to the jury or admissible at trial.
I guess I'm trying to figure out how your client's been prejudiced.
I think this recently, 2006, this case, or this court has, I think it was State v. Holman, his own statements were used in trial to impeach credibility. And this court in Holman has said that although admission of an involuntary confession violates the 14th Amendment, it does not constitute reversible error if the state can prove the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. However, this court also stated that a confession is like no other evidence, and I would submit that his statements, my client's own words, is like no other evidence, and that it can be a confession is most probably the most probative and damaging evidence that could be admitted against him, and that would be the case here. While he did make statements and not a confession, his inconsistent or varying versions of his events that day were statements that should have been suppressed and not presented to the jury at all. It's prejudicial in that it had some effect, probably. The error was, in all probability, produced some effect upon the jury's verdict and is harmful to his substantial rights. The statements would have been heavily relied upon by the jury and would have had an effect on the jury's verdict and would have had a prejudicial effect and were harmful to his rights. And again, I would assert that this was not just harmless error, but was prejudicial error. It was using his own words against him that were obtained illegally. And I think the question goes back to whether or not in Parker was he in custody. And I think from looking at the facts, the test there is whether a reasonable person would believe that he was in the suspect's position, would believe that his restraint of freedom was had been removed, or that he would no longer have the freedom to move. In this case, from the beginning at 8 a.m., around 8 a.m., when Sheriff Noblemeyer came out to Mr. Johnson's residence in Monroe, he was in the continuous presence of law enforcement. He was not allowed an opportunity to have a baby.
Just a minute, though. Excuse me, counsel, because sure. How could he have been in custody when he was offered to be given a ride home after the interview?
I think if you look at the totality of the circumstances, we're talking about just one statement from law enforcement that in and of itself is not enough to
Well, he was offered to get, there's no dispute about that fact, is there?
I believe that's in the record, yes, sir.
So how can he be in custody if the police tell him that you want to ride home?
Well, I think it's an objective test and not a subjective test. I think that's what he thought or what the officer thought. Whether he's in custody or not is not the test. It's an objective test, whether a reasonable person would have believed that. And I think if you go through the rest of the factors that his children weren't allowed to, the officers controlled the situation and controlled Mr. Johnson from the beginning. So from Sheriff Noglemeyer's arrival at his home in Monroe.
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you very much. From the beginning of Sheriff Noglemeyer's arrival, he was kept in the continuous presence of law enforcement. He was told he had no choice, that perhaps the mode of transport to Parker was up to him, but Sheriff Noglemeyer made it clear that he didn't have a choice whether to talk to Sioux Falls law enforcement. He was taken there in a marked law enforcement vehicle with an armed officer. They didn't allow him the opportunity to have his kids cared for by another babysitter. In fact, they put him in the cars and took him down to the Parker station as well. So I think clearly then at that point he was isolated from his family, and when Detective Toft began the interrogation, he was read a partial advising of Miranda. He wasn't told the critical advice that any evidence or any statement he made would be used against him in a court of law. And I think that's one of the key protections of Miranda.
So are you saying that he was in custody even though the officer offered to give him a ride home afterwards?
Yes. I think from the other factors that are present, just the officer's assertion that they had to give him a ride home is not enough to dispel the fact that he's in custody. Again, it's an objective standard, not a subjective standard, not whether an officer's making representations to him that he'll give him a ride home, but it's whether or not a reasonable person in the suspect's shoes would feel that he's in custody. And if you take all these other factual facts into consideration, it's often clear that just because the officer tells him that give him a ride home after he makes statements is not enough to preclude that to warrant that, not enough to dispel the need for Miranda. I think you can't reward the officer for failing to fully advise Mr. Johnson of his Miranda warnings.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you.
I guess I might just add that I don't intend to waive any arguments that we didn't reach tonight.
Of course. That maybe brings up a good point for those of you who are hearing the arguments. These attorneys have submitted written briefs, and they're generally 40 pages, something like that. Obviously, they only have 20 minutes, and we ask questions, so they can't cover everything that they put in their legal briefs, and they simply rely on that when their time expires. Mr. Gagan, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. As you know, the present appeal stems from an incident taking place in Baltic, South Dakota, on the morning of September 30, 2004. Now, in order to fully understand what happened that morning, the state would submit that it's important to briefly look at the facts which led up to that incident. A review of the record discloses that the victim was involved in what was described as an on-again, off-again relationship with the defendant. Now, although the two of them had a young son together, the relationship continued to deteriorate to the point where the victim testified that they were always fighting, so she therefore decided that she didn't want her son raised in that type of environment. She therefore opted to end her relationship with the defendant and move back home with her parents. Obviously, the defendant wasn't happy with the victim's decision to limit his contact with their son. So unhappy, in fact, that it caused the victim to be fearful for her safety. After moving in with her parents, the victim asked her mother to change the locks on her house because she felt very unsafe. She was afraid of the defendant and what he might do. As it turned out, those concerns were fully justified. On the morning in question, the victim was getting ready to leave for work and drive to her job in Sioux Falls. She had just finished buckling her son into his car seat when a defendant pulled into the driveway behind her. The victim testified at trial that she remembered the defendant getting out of his vehicle yelling at her. She was also able to remember the defendant pulling open her car door and threatening her, "Listen, bitch, no one is going to take my son away." The victim was later found slumped over the center console of her vehicle with her head in the front passenger seat. When help arrived, the victim told medical personnel that she'd been hit in the head with a sledgehammer. Now, we know, of course, that that's not quite what happened. The victim had been shot point blank in the forehead. When she was asked if she knew who her assailant was, the victim told EMTs that it was Fred. After she had been loaded or placed into the ambulance, she told authorities that Fred's last name was Johnson. Based on that information, the Minnehaha County Sheriff's Office issued an ATL or an attempt to locate the defendant. That then brings me to the first issue the state wants to address here today, that being whether or not the trial court erred in denying the defendant's motion to suppress his statements to the police. According to the defendant, his constitutional rights were violated because, as he alleges, he was subjected to a custodial interrogation and he was not fully advised of his Miranda rights prior to questioning.
What's our standard of review on the determination of whether or not he's in custody? Is that a clearly erroneous from the findings of fact, or do we look at that de novo?
The actual question itself involves a question of law, which is reviewed de novo, but this court has indicated in the past that you also have to look at the totality of the circumstances surrounding the interrogation, and those findings are entitled to review it under the clearly erroneous standard.
So the trial court entered findings of fact as to custody.
Yes. The trial court in this case clearly found that the defendant was not in custody. The defendant's argument in this case is premised on a statement by Sheriff Noglemeyer that he had been asked by the Minnehaha County authorities to arrest the defendant. The defendant, therefore, would have this court believe that from the very moment Sheriff Noglemeyer arrived at his residence, he was not free to leave and he was therefore in custody. The state would submit that the defendant places far too much reliance on a sheriff's statement. Here, that statement was entitled to little, if any, weight at all, given the fact that the record shows the sheriff later had what he referred to as a change of plans with regard to arresting the defendant. Defendant told Sheriff Noglemeyer that he was more than welcome to look at his vehicle, a white Honda Civic that was parked in front of the house. Defendant told the sheriff that there were mechanical problems with the vehicle, i.e., I believe it was a bad fuel pump, and that the vehicle would therefore not run. Noglemeyer indicated, therefore, that he had a change of plans about whether to arrest the defendant, and he felt uncomfortable about taking him into custody. Defendant's argument also overlooks the testimony by Sheriff Noglemeyer, and I quote, "Never did I say that he was under arrest." Instead, Sheriff Noglemeyer simply told the defendant, "Boy, you better talk to somebody else other than myself, because I'm pretty much in the dark as to what's going on here." The sheriff then asked the defendant if he would be willing to talk to detectives from Sioux Falls, and the defendant indicated that he would be glad to do so. I believe Sheriff Noglemeyer testified the defendant's exact words were, "Yeah, I want to get this thing cleared up. Yeah, I'll talk to anybody." Not only did the defendant voluntarily agree to talk to the police, there were several other factors in the record which clearly demonstrated he was not in custody. One, Sheriff Noglemeyer gave the defendant the option of waiting at his residence for the Sioux Falls detectives to arrive, or he could have ridden or accompanied Sheriff Noglemeyer to the Turner County Sheriff's Office.
Let me just kind of go forward here. What about those statements was incriminating? I mean, let me rephrase that. How central to the state's case were the defendant's statements that he made in either one of those questionnaires?
Not at all. If you look at both interviews, you'll see that the defendant never made any incriminating statement in either interview. In fact, if you watch the videotape, you will see or hear the defendant continue to maintain throughout that he was going to prove her, being the victim, wrong. The defendant was adamant that he already knew he had nothing whatsoever to do with this. He repeatedly told Detective Toff, "I know I wasn't there. I know I didn't do this." The state would therefore submit that the defendant is hard-pressed to point to any statement where he admitted to doing anything. Far more incriminating than a defendant's statement were those given by the victim to medical personnel shortly after the incident. Now, as I've already indicated, she clearly identified Fred Johnson, the defendant, as her assailant. This court has previously held that the credible testimony of a lone identification witness is sufficient to support a conviction. Now, here we have more than the testimony of the victim. There's evidence in the record which connected the defendant to the shooting. Testimony was presented that gunshot residue was found on the back of the defendant's right hand. Testimony was elicited from the state's experts that the time frame that you're likely to find GSR is about 3 hours. According to the state's expert, however, the longest time that I've ever found gunshot residue on an individual that was living was approximately 12 hours after the time of the shooting. The record, therefore, establishes the defendant discharged a firearm shortly prior to being interviewed by the police. In addition, there was gunshot residue found on the pants that the defendant was wearing that morning and gunshot residue on a vehicle, the Chevy Lumina, that the defendant had been driving that morning. The defendant offered no explanation whatsoever to account for the GSR on either his hands, clothing, or in the vehicle. Finally, we also have the testimony of a Kurt Christensen regarding a conversation he had with the defendant while the both of them were incarcerated in Minnehaha County Jail. Christensen testified and told the jury that he had a conversation with the defendant regarding his son, and the defendant's exact words were, I quote, "My son was in the back seat of the car when I shot her in the head." The defendant then proceeded to tell Christensen that was why his son was having nightmares. The state would therefore submit that there was more than ample evidence for the jury to convict the defendant, even absent his challenged statements. The other issue the state would like to briefly address here today is the defendant's argument that his conviction for both attempted murder and aggravated assault violated double jeopardy. And analyzing that issue, this court has long adopted and consistently applied the same elements test set forth in Blockberger. In Blockberger, the court said that where the same act or transaction violates two separate and distinct...
Is there a preliminary issue or a question that needs to be decided before you get to Blockberger? As I understand it, what the argument is this is one act, one victim, one gunshot wound. Why isn't that enough to meet the double jeopardy question?
Defendant relies on what's referred to or typically have been referred to as the same conduct test. The majority of courts have found that test to be inconsistent with Blockberger and therefore rejected it.
Have we done that specifically?
I believe specifically with regard to attempted murder and aggravated assault, the state would point out that in State versus Seiler, the defendant, as in this case, made an identical argument that his conviction for both attempted first-degree murder and aggravated assault violated double jeopardy. The defendant, however, later in his reply brief conceded that those two convictions did not violate the Constitution in light of the Supreme Court's case in U.S. v. Dixon, where the Supreme Court rejected the same conduct test relied on by the defendant and again reaffirmed the same elements test and stressed that in making that determination, it's strictly a statutory comparison test. You look at the elements of the statute and not at the actual proof introduced at trial.
Well, if these two, the argument, though, is that the statute doesn't make it clear and doesn't specifically say you can be convicted and sentenced for both aggravated assault and attempted murder. So the absence of, if I'm understanding the argument, the absence of that language in the statute, he says, then becomes double jeopardy.
Right. The circuit court in this case found that the absence of that language in the statute, there's no clear legislative intent to prohibit convictions for both. So the circuit court in this case relied or applied on the standard same elements test under Blockberger and found that, well, the same facts.
Can you say then that if there isn't that language in the statute, is it ambiguous then and then use the Blockberger? Or can you say because it's not there, they didn't intend it?
No, I think if it's ambiguous and it's not there, then I think the better approach would be to refer to the Blockberger analysis and apply the same elements test.
What if we did
which the circuit
what
court
if
didn't
we decided the other, that if it's not there specifically, then it's double jeopardy?
The state would submit that that's a matter of public policy, legislative intent, and the legislature has had multiple opportunities to clarify that it never intended for multiple punishments, i.e. aggravated assault, attempted first-degree murder. As I pointed out and cited to in the state's brief, this exact issue was raised in State versus Seiler, but then was later withdrawn, and there have been at least two other subsequent cases that the state's aware of where the defendant has been convicted of both attempted first-degree murder and aggravated assault.
So we're going to let stupidity trump common sense?
I guess I question the usage of the word stupidity in light of the fact that presumably this court, had it seen or believed there was a constitutional problem, could have raised that issue under the plain error doctrine in State versus Seiler and in two other cases referred to in the state's brief where the defendant was convicted of both offenses.
Well, let's go at it another way. Certainly the legislature knows how to make two different types of conduct punishable separately, don't they?
And I believe they did in this instance case by requiring specific different elements for each offense.
But they never indicated here that there was any intent to impose multiple punishments for this one act.
Because there seems in the past to have ever been a question that that was inappropriate in light of the pastor's prior decisions from this court.
So you think the legislature then, like, intended in this instance where there's one gunshot to the head, obviously either murder, depending on whether the victim dies, or attempted murder, they also were approving punishments for aggravated assault, maybe trespassing in the vehicle, and abuse and neglect of the of his son in the back seat. Could have been punished for all of those, according
applying,
to you?
Applying the same elements test, the circuit court specifically found that each statute required proof of a different element, i.e., attempted murder required a premeditated design, which is not present in aggravated assault, and likewise, aggravated assault required serious bodily injury, which is not required for
right.
attempted murder.
And in trespassing, there's a different element. So they could have been punished for that. He could have been punished for that, too. He abused and neglected his child by leaving him in the back seat, and then he departed. And
that wasn't the case, and I guess I would reserve the resolution of the particular issues on appeal to the facts that are present and not some hypothetical.
Well, I mean, he did leave the child in the back seat, and he stuck the gun in the car, and he shot the woman in the head.
Right. Obviously, he left the child in the seat because it would have been pretty apparent that had he taken a child, he would have implicated himself in the attempted murder, aggravated assault.
So he should be punished for anything else that constitutes another crime.
Again, within the matter of prosecutorial election, it's up to the state's attorney to determine what charges to bring. And if the trial court had found that was inappropriate, it could have easily granted a motion to dismiss.
Yeah, I think it should be up to the legislature, not up to the state's attorney, to impose punishments as he sees fit.
Right, but like I said, the legislature, based on past precedent from this court, has had ample opportunity to amend the statute, and it yet, at this point in time, has not done so.
This is a little different, isn't it, though, because of the facts of this case? I mean, it is the same act, the same victim, the same gunshot, everything. I mean, you could argue with Justice Sabers with leaving your child in the back seat. That involves a whole different victim and so on. But this, in this case, they were not charged in the alternative.
No.
They were both charged. And yet it was absolutely the same evidence supported the conviction of both of them.
True, but in order to adopt the defendant's argument, you would have to overrule prior precedent from this court where we've adopted Blockberger analysis in the same elements test and now switched to the same conduct test, which was relied on by the defendant.
If the Blockberger test is a rule of statutory construction. I mean, that's how we...
Correct.
You look at
the elements of the statute
and
the absence of any clear legislative intent.
But if you don't get there, I mean, is it possible to determine this without getting to the Blockberger test?
The state would submit that in light of any expressed legislative intent to the contrary, we need to look at the elements of the test in order to arrive at a proper determination of the issue.
How do you clearly express something if you're the legislature by inaction, by doing nothing, by letting things go on as they go on? I mean, the requirement is they can clearly express an intent to cause multiple punishments.
True. But obviously, as we all know, there have been recent major revampments of the criminal code section. And that was subsequent to the case decided to refer to in the state's brief where the defendant had been convicted on both charges, as in this particular case, i.e., attempted first-degree murder and aggravated assault. Again, so the state would submit that the opportunity was there, but the legislature, through the defense bar, didn't take any remedial action to correct that.
But the legislature passed up that opportunity, and they have not clearly expressed their intent to cause multiple punishments for the same crime.
I guess the state would believe that by passing up the opportunity, the legislature meant to reaffirm the fact that, again, in accordance with prior precedent from this court, they are not a double jeopardy violation to convict both. So I guess unless there are any further questions from the court, the state would close by simply asking that the defendant's conviction and sentence be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Gagan.
Thank you.
Mr. Hall, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you very much. I just
Before you start, can you answer that? Do we have to overrule prior precedent to buy your theory of the double jeopardy issue?
No, you would not, Justice Meyerhander. I think just the recent 2001 case of the State v. Dillon basically shows how this court should analyze this elements here in this case, in that in State v. Dillon, you had the act of a sexual penetration resulting in multiple charges, rape first,
raping first degree and criminal pedophilia. And this court looked beyond just the mere words of the statute and looked at the meaning behind those words. And just because the statutes use different words does not bar the conclusion that they contain the same elements. So it's not a situation where you have to go against precedent here. It's if you apply the Blockberger test and compare the statutes and the meaning behind those words, then, as I alluded to earlier, you have the greater intent of attempted murder swallowing up the intent of aggravated assault, and you have the conduct element, you have the spectrum of no injury to near death, and somewhere along that spectrum is bodily injury. So you have just one conduct, not different conduct, but a range of outcomes, possible outcomes. And I think the state maybe relies a little bit too much on State v. Seiler, and that is distinguishable, and I think perhaps not to put my judgment in place of the trial counsel in that case, but in that one we had the situation was there was several lacerations, there was an event that lasted 3 to 4 hours, there was cuts to the stomach, cuts to the throat, cuts to the wrist. So there were several, more than one transaction in that case, and they were several different charges that arose from those from those injuries. So it's a case that's distinguishable from this, in that here all we have is one single shot, one incident, one injury, not an event lasting 3 to 4 hours, and not several injuries. So I think that case is clearly distinguishable. And again, if the statute had wanted to allow multiple punishments, or if the legislature had wanted to allow multiple punishments for the aggravated assault and the attempted murder, they clearly could have done so. As this
so
court.
Do we get to the Blockberger test or don't we? And if we do, what's your answer to that as far as the elements? Because the elements are different.
To address your first question, I think if the statutes are not clear that the multiple punishment is intended, then perhaps you don't even have to go to Blockberger. If you do the same offense test in Blockberger, I think the defense, Mr. Johnson, still prevails, in that if you compare the elements to the statute, and not just the words in those statutes, but the meaning behind them, and the fact that you have a greater intent to kill swallowing up the intent to commit bodily injury. They merge together. For as far as the injury goes, the conduct, you have a wide range of, it's not a different outcome, it's just one of many outcomes that could have arisen from the attempted murder statute. The attempt is a very generic, loosely defined, broadly defined statute. So a lot of outcomes could come from...
Therein is the problem, isn't it? With your argument?
I don't believe so. Because I think if you look beyond just the meaning of the words, or just the words, the face value of the words, if you look at the meaning behind them, you have an intent to kill that is swallowed up, that swallows up the intent to commit bodily injury. And I think that the legislature is pretty clear in its hierarchy of criminal intent that it outlines or spells out which is included in the other. And I think certainly the spirit of that statute includes the fact that the intent to kill would swallow up or consume the intent to commit bodily injury. And it's almost frightening to think otherwise, because what could potentially happen would be in any aggravated assault or any an assault case that's similar to this, the prosecutors could charge out attempted murder even if they couldn't prove the underlying charge of murder. I mean, it would allow the prosecutors to pile on charges and just add an attempted murder count if they felt they couldn't prove the underlying case. Regarding the Miranda issue, opposing counsel raised up, I think Miranda is pretty clear that anything you say can be used against you, not just confessions. I think it's clear that any statements that are made should be suppressed if they were obtained in violation of Miranda, not just confessions. I would argue again that it's not harmless error, that his statements would have been had a profound effect upon the jury. They're his own words, and would have had an effect that was prejudiced his substantial rights.
Doesn't it all hinge on whether or not he was in custody?
The Miranda, yes.
Yes. And we look at the trial court's findings of fact under a clearly erroneous standard as far as the custody issue. What was clearly erroneous about the trial court's determination, findings of fact, on the custody issue?
I think the trial court, respectfully say that the trial court erred in the fact that looking at all the reasons that I've alluded to earlier, indicate that a reasonable person would have believed that he was in custody in the suspect's shoes. Not because Mr. Johnson was willing to talk or felt like he had a desire to talk. That's not the test. It's whether or not the person, it's a reasonable person. And a reasonable person would have felt that he was in custody if, from step one, an armed deputy, or sheriff in this case, came to his residence, told him that he was there to arrest him. Nothing was told otherwise. If Mr. Sheriff Noglemeyer had any doubts, he certainly didn't. There's nothing in the record to support that he conveyed that doubt to Mr. Johnson. He told me he had no choice but to go down to talk with the law enforcement from Sioux Falls, go down again in the sheriff's vehicle. They don't allow him an opportunity to have a babysitter care for his kids at the house. Instead, they bring him down to the police station until his ex-wife Sheila can get down there to take care of the kids. And then at that point, he's isolated from his family. Detective Toff comes in, partially reads in Miranda. I think it's, I mean, in my experience, an officer, when they begin an interrogation or they begin just a fact-finding questioning of a suspect, they don't go into Miranda. They tell them the door is unlocked, you're free to leave, you can go at any time, we're not going to arrest you today. Of course, they might arrest them the next day, but they don't tell them they're going to arrest them today. And those are all what tactics law enforcement uses to let the to convey to the suspect that he's not in custody. In this case, the first thing Detective Toff says is that...
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you very much. The first thing that Detective Toff says is that, hey, when I have to ask you some questions, I have to read you some things. And that's when he begins the advising of Miranda.
Right, and then Johnson interrupts him and says, oh, no, I'm ready to get it all cleared up and everything.
Right.
So isn't he bound by that? Isn't that the equivalent of being read Miranda rights?
No, sir, I would respectfully disagree. I think that it certainly does my client's eagerness to say something does not relieve law enforcement of their duty to fully advise a suspect of his constitutional rights.
Well, he did get most of them read to him, didn't he?
Yes. The one that did not was the critical advice that anything he said could be used against him in a court of law.
He should get the advantage of that by him shutting off the officer and saying, I don't want to hear any more. I want to get this over with. You know, let's get on with it. And then he should still be held not to have had Miranda rights read to him?
Yes, sir, exactly. I think this because the suspect interrupts law enforcement does not relieve the law enforcement officer from having to fully advise a suspect of his constitutional rights. It would be condoning improper law enforcement, put that badly, but you can understand my point. It would be condoning the fact that it would be relieving law enforcement of their obligation to fully advise a suspect of their constitutional rights, including the right against self-incrimination.
Well, what's wrong with that? If the defendant says, I don't want to hear any more, let's get on with it. I want to get this over with.
And I believe that's, in my mind, I don't know that that's a proper recollection of what was exactly said, but I would say that there's a lot wrong with that. I think that the constitutional protections should be in place to protect all of us, including a criminal defendant, and that they should, and a suspect's eagerness to talk should not override or supersede law enforcement's obligation to fully convey those rights to a defendant.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time is expired.
Just one question. So your argument is that you can't waive a constitutional right?
Yes, sir. That's right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.